The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You're filling out an online form and check a box for your age, income, family size, and then are asked to identify your ethnicity, Asian, Black, Caucasian, Hispanic, or other. When filling out online surveys or credit card applications, being asked to disclose race can feel unnecessary or, worse, offensive. Would you feel the same way about divulging your race if it meant the expensive clothes you were ordering would fit better? The online retailer Proper Cloth calculates the precise size for custom-tailored men's shirts and suits, in part by asking about height, weight, and ethnicity. Moises Velasquez-Manoff is an author and science writer who looked into the implications of that question and the real and imagined connections between biology and ethnicity. His article, Can a Dress Shirt Be Racist?, appeared on Back Channel. And Moises, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about this company first, Proper Cloth. Who's behind it?
Well, it's a smallish startup, and it was founded by a fellow named Seth Skerritt. And their premise is basically to ship to your house a tailor-fitted dress shirt without you having to go through all the bother of going to the store or even getting measured by a tailor. And so they've developed this algorithm they call Smart Sizes. And it asks about things you probably would predict, like, as you mentioned, like height and weight. And it also actually asks about the measurements of your shirt, like your sleeve length, if you happen to know it. But then it asks a few things that you probably wouldn't predict. And this is sort of their, what they claim is their innovation, like belly size, for example. This is the sort of, because belly size does not always correlate with your waist size, which you probably know, but your belly size you might not know. So they ask you sort of to gauge, do you have a big belly, a small belly, that sort of thing. And then they ask you about ethnicity. So when I first was sort of fooling around with their algorithm, that question sort of stopped me cold because I remembered from my Anthro 101 class, or maybe it was one class back in college, that there's actually a certain amount of controversy about whether or not we have a certain body shape that's according to our ancestry, that's linked to our ancestry. Clearly, anthropologists used to think that those were very easily made assumptions or easily made measurements, but modern anthropologists, for a whole host of reasons, are much less likely to say these things are true.
So I'm curious, how did they come up with this idea of ethnicity? Was this, you know, a focus group that said people want to buy clothing that's more ethnically tailored? How did they come up with this?
Well, in the beginning, they were basically testing out their algorithm, their list of questions. And they made 30 shirts for 30 guys in the Dog Patch Labs in New York City where they were housed. And they observed that, among the many other things that did not work in those early days, that the shirts seemed to not fit certain ethnicities. That is, they fit them worse, certain ethnicities. And actually, when I spoke with Seth Skerritt, he didn't remember what the ethnicities were. So I just have to use an example. Like the Asian guys, for example, the shirts seemed to fit terribly on them, and they needed to have the same alterations done. So what the company does basically is they'll alter the shirt for you. You go through one round, and you can send it back and say, oh, I need this such adjusted, and they'll alter it for you. Of course, they want to minimize those alterations because they're costly. They want to get it right the first time.
So what are the alleged differences that they're saying between ethnicities?
Well, it's like subtle differences in what anthropologists would call limb-to-trunk ratio, and that is the sort of the length of your limbs compared to your trunk. So, like, your arms are a little bit longer compared to your trunk in one ethnicity versus another. And so that, of course, it impacts pretty tremendously how well your fitted shirt fits. So they added this ethnicity question. I mean, I should say the first thing they did was look up to see if anyone else had looked into this question and found any differences that were predictable according to ethnicity. And, of course, the Army has. The Army has this anthropometry survey where they measure incoming recruits. And there are these differences according to those data. that the Army has. That sample of people is not representative of Americans at large necessarily, because those are Army recruits, so it's a self-selected group.
Right.
But what Proper Class says they've done is they've basically continued to evolve their algorithm based on their own data. Based on, now they have a database of 20,000 people, and so their algorithm is learning based on those people.
Well, okay, so as you pointed out, there is a history. You said early anthropologists had this idea that there was a biological element to race, and we're using race, ethnicity kind of interchangeably for this story. Tell us a little bit about the history of that. I mean, is there much in the way of scientific evidence that the metric is doing what Skerritt claims it does, that clothes will fit better if ethnicity is a factor in literally sizing someone up?
Well, so it's interesting. First of all, we can't verify that proper cloth clothes shirts actually do fit better with that question, because they're not conducting a scientific trial where you sort of make everything transparent so people can replicate it. They just say it's true. We have to take them at their word or not. We can go talk to anthropologists. And basically what anthropologists say, first of all, let me back up. Clearly, our eyes tell us that there are pretty dramatic differences between what we call races and skin color and hair texture and all sorts of things. Clearly, there's tremendous variation in the human family. But the question that anthropologists raise is, are the old race labels the best way to describe that variation? And pretty much every anthropologist I queried about this said absolutely not. It's not because necessarily it's not a nice thing to do, even though that's part of the answer, that it's a little bit dangerous to sort of perpetuate these labels. But it's also because literally the facts of human variation don't fit those race labels. There are no sort of clean breaks in the way we perhaps think that there are. And I use the example in the piece of sort of walking across the Eurasian continent at a northern latitude, let's say, from Europe to Japan. There's no line necessarily where people suddenly start looking different. Mm-hmm. There'll be the sort of gradual change in how people look. So if you were to look at that and say, okay, where do we say that Europeans begin and Asians begin? Well, that doesn't exist. It's an arbitrary line.
Well, okay, so for you, I mean, okay, those are assigned judgments, right? And this idea that we have that race is a social construct. You know, it's based
That's
on
right.
power. It's based on history giving preference to one over the other. So what do you think of this question? You know, if you were taking that walk along the northerly latitude, you wouldn't notice differences, you know, distinct differences from place to place, what variations. So what's going on here? What did you find in your examination of this question about ethnicity and shirt size?
Well, it's sort of a paradox, actually, because the academics say we shouldn't use these labels. We should get away from using them. And we should talk about what we're really talking about, which is, you know, take your actual measurements. That's the best way to determine whether your shirt is going to fit well or not. And, of course, proper cloth is taking your actual measurements. They're just sort of claiming that there's something extra that they get out of asking about ethnicity. But on the other hand, you know, in the United States and in many Western countries, we're sort of very cosmopolitan. It's just a mixture of all sorts of different kinds of people. And there's like this yearning to just forget about all the old baggage and just acknowledge that we have different bodies according to where we come from. And marketers are beginning to market to this, aside from proper cloth, which they're doing it in a sort of at least it seems scientific kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are these other efforts like there are these Asian fit glasses that are supposedly designed to fit on more Asian faces. And I've talked to a number of people that have no problem with that idea. The anthropologist would say, well, look, instead of calling them Asian fit, describe the features you're trying to fit to. But marketers are looking for easy ways, shorthand.
So you have Asian fit glasses, and that's not bothersome to people that you talk to. But, you know, what's the next thing? You know, the sort of Jewish fit glasses or something for Hispanics who have a large growing population with obesity. So
right. What's funny you should mention that, because actually there were a few years ago some jeans company tried to have a Latina fit jeans. They got in a whole lot of trouble as they tried to explain to reporters, well, what we're after is we're trying to design for the more voluptuous Latina body. And
uh-huh.
It's like, you know, they had probably some he was probably white, but basically this male CEO explaining this, but that they'd measured Latinas' bodies, and it was just it just came off completely horribly for the company. Even earlier, I found an example of a JCPenney having like a section for African Americans, which also caused a lot of controversy. But I don't know if they were designing for any kind of body proportions in that case.
Well, how do we know that the proper cloth is not basing size based on kind of cultural differences rather than racial ones, meaning that, you know, different demographics may prefer clothes that fit in different ways, right? I mean, that's true,
that's
at least
true.
In
yeah.
a broad sense.
Absolutely, and we don't know that, and they don't know that either, which is what's interesting. They're not really sure if when they ask that question, the information they're capturing is really about physical body proportions, or maybe it's about cultural preferences or subcultural preferences for how you have your shirt fit. So you're absolutely right. It could be that. And they don't care. What they care is that their shirt fits the way the customer wants it to fit.
So race, of course, is a broad generalization, as you said. You know, there's a lot of variation. And it seems like we have this kind of dualistic relationship to all kinds of generalizations. You know, sometimes they're useful to us, sometimes they're dangerous. I'm wondering, after looking at this, you know, from an anthropological, from an historical, from even a social and fashion point of view, what did you come away thinking, Moises?
That it's very, very complicated. But I also, that we live in this 21st century sort of tech-oriented world where we're told over and over that big data is the answer to everything. All you need is to have a big enough data set, and then you can parse it, and you'll see patterns, essentially. And that's proper cloth is doing a version of that, sort of. But the labels that we use to organize our data have history, and they have historical baggage. And I feel like sometimes people ignore the baggage possibly to their peril, because you can't just pretend it doesn't exist. You know, you can't pretend history doesn't exist. It's not wise.
Well, Moises, thank you very much for speaking with us about this really thought-provoking article.
Thanks for having me.
Moises Velasquez-Manoff, he's author and science writer, and you'll find a link to read his article, Can a Dress Shirt Be Racist?, which he wrote for Back Channel. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Our clothing says a lot about who we are. Whether flashy or simple, new or used, the things we fashion around our bodies speak volumes. Before the break, we talked about whether race and ethnicity determine size and fit. Well, in this story, producer Abby Wendell speaks with Erica Rasmussen, an artist who makes clothes that reflect our notions of beauty and the dangers that lie therein.
Can you just list off some of the materials that you use in your work?
Oh, sure. Let's see. Poodle hair, watermelon seeds, dehydrated cherries, human hair, silk suture thread, apricots.
Blood, that's true.
Blood, that's right, bovine blood. Yeah.
Erica Rasmussen uses these materials in what can most simply be described as clothing sculpture. From a distance, she makes corsets and dresses and coats. But up close, her corset is covered in matchsticks. The interior of her jacket is lined with dehydrated cherry tomatoes. And her little black dress? It's made from the kind of paper you sit on at a doctor's office. Her work is detail-oriented and labor-intensive. It gives her a lot of time to think about the sacrifices Americans make to be beautiful, about living in a body that one day is going to get sick, and about how to die with grace. We begin our conversation with Rasmussen describing a sculpture she calls Dirty Little Secret.
It's a dress, and it's kind of fleshy in tone, and it has these polka dots all over it, and it hangs in space, it rotates from fish line, and underneath it I pour a ring of horse hair, little clips of hair, And it's about secret X-ray hair removal. Do you know anything about that?
I do not.
Well, apparently when the X-ray was invented around 1900, people soon found that hair effortlessly, painlessly would fall out. And so these clinics were set up all around the United States, and women would go to these clinics, be exposed to the X-ray machines, and it was a way of controlling their body hair and sometimes their facial hair. The women who practiced this X-ray hair removal eventually became sick. But this little dress that I fashioned is a poignant example, I think, of how dangerous the pursuit of beauty in this culture can be. It can be, especially because we're so technologically driven, right? Certainly all cultures modify the body in some way, and all cultures have visions of ideal beauty. But this particular piece, you know, from a distance, it kind of calls you in. It's a nice feminine shape. But then you get up closer and you discover there's something wrong here. Yeah, and I like that tension between that which is beautiful and grotesque.
I read something on your website that said your work addresses, but it also dissolves fears you have about your body.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what kind of fears you've had.
Mm. When I was a little girl, my father told me that eating tomatoes would make me big, strong, and hairy-chested. I stopped eating tomatoes for 20 years. My brother went on to eat tomatoes, and you should see how hairy he turned out.
Did you like tomatoes as a child?
No, I don't think I was a really big tomato fan.
So it wasn't like a battle for you? It just kind of like, well, I don't want that.
That's right. I mean, I think I recognized from a very young age that men had very different grooming practices and physical attributes than women, and I think one of my larger fears is about being masculine or unattractive. And certainly that whole idea of excess bodily hair, you know, was quite terrifying to me as a young person. I'm a big woman. I'm 5'10". I have size 11 feet. I have dark hair and pale skin. So sometimes dancing between masculinity and femininity is a little tenuous, you know? So I have a lot of fears, and some of them are far more common. You know, I'm afraid of death. And there was another piece you saw on the show called The Beginning of the End, which is a work that harbors my first gray hair.
Yes, this what you're talking about is it's like a little memory box.
Right.
And it's got a photo of you dressed up in your mom's clothing.
Right.
And then curled up in the box is your first silver hair.
Gray hair, yeah.
Well, when did you find it? Where were you? What were you doing?
I was in London doing research with my husband, and he was helping me do something like part my hair in the back or I don't know what, but he found it, and I was 28. I kept that gray hair in an envelope probably for 10 years or more until it occurred to me what I would need it for.
And how did you know when you were ready?
Once I settled into my 40s, and there were more gray hairs.
There's hair in another piece that I want to talk about. The Book of Desires?
Book of Desires.
The Book of Desires.
Yeah. It's modeled after 16th century Flemish neckwear. So think of big collars and round ruffs, right, that used to be worn by nobility and so forth.
Yeah, like Elizabethan
Yeah. It started in the 16th century. I began making that shape really as a physical challenge, just to see if I could make such a collar. But then my mom became sick. She, this was 8 years ago, she became ill with breast cancer for the second time in her life. And when I knew her hair was going to fall out and that she was going to have to go through chemotherapy, I asked her to save her hair for me. And I used her silver or her white hair. I threw in little pieces into my paper vat, and I pulled charcoal or black sheets of paper. And then I ran these sheets of paper through my inkjet printer with prayers or wishes. I hope that my mother will see Venice. I hope that she'll spend time in her garden. I wish that she can see her grandson grow. And although I found that my attempts to enlist magical forces may not have worked, she's not healed. She's not fixed, you know. I have found that making these objects helps me.
And that story was produced by Abby Wendell for This Land Press.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
To say I'm thrilled to be here would be an understatement. I look forward to this event every year. Time that we honor our 2015 National Student Poets. Don't they look good? They look good. Bow ties.
That is First Lady Michelle Obama at the White House introducing the current class of National Student Poets. That's the nation's highest honor for young poets. Eileen Huang is one of only 5 students chosen from nearly 20,000 submissions. So what is expected of a National Student Poet? Well, Eileen is touring schools and libraries here in New Hampshire, and we are lucky to have her with us during April, National Poetry Month. And Eileen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you.
So
I'm
glad you're
excited
here.
Excited to be here.
Well, we're really glad to have you here. Now, I was reading up on you, and I found that you attend a high technology high school in New Jersey. It's a STEM school. How did you discover poetry? We normally think of them existing in separate universes.
Yeah, it's actually kind of a funny story, and it's weird that my school is literally called High Tech High School, which is probably the worst name for a school ever.
Not named by a poet, I could tell you that.
Definitely. It's kind of a funny story, actually. I started off not really liking poetry as a kid, but I read a lot. And one day I was in my middle school library and I came across this anthology of poems from Keats to like Ginsberg and all those like newer poets. And I instantly became hooked and I was like, hey, if they can write this, maybe I can. And I tried out some poetry and I ended up writing a lot. And then once I started writing it, I kind of got the hang of it and felt like it was probably the best way to explain my emotions and to make them more tangible.
So you were hooked. Was it one poem, one line, everything?
My first poem that I ever like seriously read through was probably Robert Frost, The Road Not Taken. And I'd seen it before, but it'd always be at like Barnes & Noble and I see like the magnet that says, I chose the road less traveled and that has made all the difference. And I was like, oh, that's some like cheesy stuff. But I read this poem through and I tried to like analyze it and I started to realize that maybe it's like more nuanced than that and it's more meaningful and it's more about like the choices we make and whether or not they really hold any gravity. And I thought that aspect was really interesting, and the fact that it was conveyed through poetry, something I previously thought was like this unattainable art form that was only reserved for like elite professionals. The fact that it came through that and that poetry was the vessel to tell this story, I thought that was really fascinating.
So you're also from a family of engineers. Now, what did they think of this poetry thing that you caught on to?
Oh, yeah. My parents are really supportive. They're really proud of me.
Are they both engineers?
They're both engineers. And I grew up like surrounded by a lot of engineering influences, like math and science. A lot of my friends also like math and science. And my parents actually didn't really know what this program was at first. I told them I'd been selected as a National Student Poet, and they're like, oh, okay, that's cool. I didn't really know what it was. But then, like, we were sitting one row behind the First Lady, like, right behind her. And I think that's probably when it hit them. They were like, oh, wait,
this
matters.
Well, what does it mean, actually, to be a National Student Poet? You're one of 5 who are chosen. Now, what do you do?
So the National Student Poets Program is the nation's highest honor for youth poets presenting original work. And basically, 5 students are chosen from different regions of the country. There's like the Southwest, Northeast, West region. I'm the Northeast National Student Poet. So I go around in my community and region and teach poetry workshops or kind of promote this love for humanities and arts. I've actually been working on a community service project where I go to middle schools and help kids there learn how to love poetry and appreciate it as much as I did, like when I found that anthology of poems. Mm-hmm. I just hope to kind of inspire that kind of passion in kids my age or younger.
I'm wondering how you do it. I mean, you obviously hadn't been gripped by poetry in middle school. So how do you work with the kids? How do you inspire them?
I think the reason that so many kids are turned like away from poetry is because the way it's taught to them or the way they've been exposed to it is not that interesting to them. I remember like reading earlier poems in high school or whenever, when the poetry is like this common core thing and it's like required and it's like all these old poems that, you know, students can't really connect to. Like, can you really relate to like Milton? Can you really relate to all those epic sonnets or whatever? And I always felt really detached from it. But once you start reading modern poetry, and I recently started reading poetry written by people who are not even that much older than me, like they're younger poets, new contemporary poets, and you think, wow, this really resonates with me. So one thing I do with middle schoolers and even with high schooler students is show them poems that I'm interested in and not just poems that they're like forced to or required to learn. And I think just by sharing that and kind of opening people up to something they've never experienced before makes them really interested in it. And usually when I teach workshops, I get like one kid who's like super excited about poetry afterwards, which is really great for me.
How old are you?
I'm 16 right now.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the poems that you use with these kids that you're excited about?
I just used Wild Geese by Mary Oliver with a few students in high school, and they seem to have liked it. And I also used Billy Collins' poems, and I say this a lot, but I like to think of him as like the Pixar of poetry because, mm-hmm. you know, adults and children really like him a lot because he's so funny, yet serious and thoughtful at the same time. And there are a lot of like actual meanings behind his poems. So I think by showing students or by showing kids that poetry can be funny, poetry can be meaningful, poetry can be relatable is what makes it such a like important vessel and important genre for students to study.
So that you said one kid you often feel like kind of gets it. Do the kids connect? How do you know that they're in there? How do you know that it's touching them?
I think, well, it doesn't work for everyone. And obviously, my poetry workshops are definitely far from perfect. Like, sometimes I'll see kids, like, on their iPhones. Mm-hmm. And I'll be like, stop, listen to me. But I think, like, afterwards, there'd always be that one kid who comes up and says, like, thank you so much. Or, like, wants to, like, take a selfie with me. And I'm not saying that to brag or anything, but just to show that it makes me so happy just to see people really appreciate poetry and what it's done for them.
Well, if I may say, Eileen, 16 years old, one of five chosen in the country, I think you can brag. You have every right to brag. Would you like to share a poem of yours?
Yeah, sure. I have my poetry from the National Student Poets chapbook with me. I'll share Confluence. This is a poem I wrote a long time ago. And I wrote it because when I was younger, I went to a boarding school in China, and it was this all-Chinese boarding school, and I was in a class with all Chinese students, and everyone thought I was just a Chinese student who was really stupid because I couldn't really speak any Mandarin. But one part of the class was they had us write and recite or memorize these ancient Chinese poems, and I think I was memorizing so much to the point where it was like stuck in my head, and I wrote this poem about them. It's called Confluence. Tang Dynasty poems are four lines each. Breaks between cadences, each character a curve, iron hook, slicing black scissor slashes against textbook paper. I am no Li Bai, for instead of wine, I drink the laws of thermodynamics, and I pass time under the home screen of a Nokia rather than moonlight. The foot of my bed, nothing more than a scuffing of crushed cockroaches. I do not need lullabies when I can recite stanzas in my sleep. They're four-beat, jumping voices, buzzing like dragonflies in hollow ear canals. They speak of rivers, looping islands, yellow-brown mud sloshing behind rocks in the shapes of warriors who jumped across gorges in pursuit of wild tigers. I press knees against littered plastic bags and feel them crunch like insects under bare feet. I do not need to pretend that I am standing at the edge of a river, one toe in the flowing mud, arm resting against the sandbanks. and I do not need blankets when I have the lisping voices of Su Song to sing me to sleep.
That's Eileen Huang. She's reading Confluence, her poem there. You say, I'm no Li Bai. Isn't that an ancient Chinese poet, right?
Yeah,
one of the most famous.
Yeah.
But it's so funny listening to that. You read that here, you know, about being in Beijing and not speaking perfect Chinese. You know, the experience that so many people have here as immigrants, first-generation Americans, you know, not being able to speak the language. Do you meet a lot of those students when you're in your doing your workshops?
I haven't actually done any workshops with students who practice English as a second language, but that's something I'd definitely be interested in because just going to China and just not really knowing the culture there and knowing how to speak the language fluently was a bit overwhelming for me. And I found that by having people support me and by having people help me, if I didn't know how to pronounce something or when I was like ordering something at Starbucks, and I didn't know how to say, like, Frappuccino in Chinese. Having that person in line just tell me how to say it and help me through it really kind of made my stay there a lot better and a lot more meaningful. So I definitely like to help students who don't have English as their first language. And I think that art and poetry is a great way to reach those students.
So now you're thinking about being a poet for your life? I mean, is this a vocation that you want to pursue? And how would your parents feel about that?
My parents would be supportive of me no matter what I do. But I think I'm probably too young to decide at this point. And a lot of people ask me that question. My answer is always, I don't know, because I'm still definitely figuring it out. But I think having this award and having this honor and having this experience of going out and meeting other students who are equally passionate about poetry as I am has really opened up my eyes to a lot more opportunities. Like before this, I was kind of like, oh, I'll probably just grow up and be like a doctor or a lawyer or someone. But I think having this opportunity and having this experience has opened up so many more doors for me.
Well, you don't have to decide yet. And thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Eileen Huang, she's a sophomore at High Technology High School in New Jersey and one of five students in the 2015 class of National Student Poets. She's been touring the state doing workshops at schools and libraries here in New Hampshire. You'll find much more about the prestigious program. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Although the word vitamin has been around for just over a century, the symptoms of vitamin deficiencies have been a blight on human health through the ages. Among them, swollen limbs, rotting gums, scaling of the skin, convulsions, internal hemorrhaging, and a litany of other horrors. Today, essential nutrients are added to processed food, and billions of dollars are spent on the almost entirely unregulated vitamin and supplement market. Journalist Catherine Price writes about the history, science, and beliefs surrounding these chemicals, manufactured and sold without any requirement to prove their safety, efficacy, or even composition. Her book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection, and it's now out in paperback. I spoke with her last year when it was first published. So I just mentioned some of the diseases or symptoms of diseases like scurvy and rickets and beriberi. Why does the body need vitamins?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I've never heard anyone make internal hemorrhaging sound so cheerful. So that was kind of nice there. But yes, basically our bodies have evolved to need these 13 dietary chemicals that we know as vitamins, which is an important clarification to make up front, is that the word vitamin is often used to refer to the much broader category of dietary supplements, which is basically like everything you see in the drugstore when you go into the supposed vitamin aisle. But these 13 substances, A, D, E, K, C, and the 8 B vitamins, our bodies do need. And what's interesting is that we may have originally been able to make some of these substances, including vitamin C, but for some reason, we've evolved to not be able to make most of these from our diet. So we need them in order to facilitate chemical reactions that keep our bodies running.
Now, there are so many foods that are fortified and enriched with vitamins. And you write about this as a convergence of two things, you know, an increase in processed food and a kind of
magical thinking or belief in the power of vitamins. Can you kind of bring those two together for us?
Sure. So the first synthetic, by which I mean man-made vitamins, were created in the 1930s and 40s. And it was around the time that there also was a big increase in foods made from refined grains and a lot of processing going on. So the problem with the processing is that while it's necessary to have that kind of processing in order to have foods with long shelf lives, it also tends to destroy the vitamins and natural nutrients in that food. So that is part of the reason that fortification first started happening to the American food supply, was to make sure that these products wouldn't actually leave us in a state of deficiency. But at the same time, vitamins were enormously appealing to food marketers right from the beginning. So as you mentioned, the word was only coined in 1911, and that was actually before any vitamin had been chemically isolated. That didn't happen until thiamine in 1926. But even before then, you started to see food companies start to advertise the vitamin content of their products. And basically, it was just because, you know, vitamins, first of all, great word, fantastic marketing term. Mm-hmm. But second, if you give a vitamin to someone who actually has a severe deficiency, you actually will have miraculous results. If you give someone vitamin C who has scurvy, they'll get better. I mean, it's really pretty amazing. They are miracle drugs in that case. But, you know, what we did erroneously is to apply this idea of miracles beyond the purposes that vitamins are actually intended for and beyond the capabilities that they can actually, that they actually have.
Well, we get back to how we play shortcuts with nutrition, as you call it, this magical thinking. And so you said, you know, a little bit of vitamin C will do something about scurvy. So our thinking is a little bit will do good, so a lot will be great. So does taking a super dose of vitamins actually help us?
I would say that that's not a good idea. And it is a very interesting tendency in terms of how we think of vitamins, that since a little bit is necessary and a moderate amount is not going to cause any immediate bad things to happen to you, then we assume that if we took a lot of a vitamin, then it must be able to do fantastic things for us. And that is, I think, a dangerous way to think about it. You know, for the most part, vitamins aren't going to hurt you in the short term, with the main exception being vitamin A, which can be toxic to your liver. But over a long period of time, having high levels of vitamins can mess up other other things going on in your body. Like, for example, vitamin D, if you were to take a true superdose of that for a long time, you might mess up how much calcium your body is absorbing and end up with deposits of calcium in places other than your bones, like your kidneys, where you don't want them. And the other thing about stuff like vitamin C, which is a water-soluble vitamin, so a lot of people will say, oh, it's totally safe, you just pee it out, no big deal. If you were to take really a lot of vitamin C for a long period of time, we don't really know what that would do to you. And so I think it's a much better idea to just try to stick to the doses of most vitamins that you could get in foods that naturally contain them.
You're listening to my previous conversation with the journalist Catherine Price, author of Vitamania, which is now out in paperback. The book covers her investigation of how vitamins and supplements came to be added to our food and diets, and whether they're effective or even necessary. This idea that a superdose of vitamins will cure all ails, it reminds me of, you know, like, you know those patent medicines back in the Victorian era, you know, Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup or Allen's remedy for corpulence or something. Those remind me of the claims that are made about what vitamins and supplements can do. Now, in the book, you trace the lack of regulation about vitamins and supplements to industry lobbying. When did this really begin in earnest?
Well, first off, I need to say the reason that Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup works so well and those patent medicines was often because they contain like cocaine and morphine. So they actually did
work really
pretty
well. It really did soothe.
yeah, exactly. I mean, almost, you know, often too effectively. But in terms of supplements, they are regulated in the United States, but they are not regulated in the way that you and I would assume and the way that many consumers would want them to be, I think, if they knew more of the details. Basically, they are, as you pointed out, not required to be tested for safety or efficacy before being sold. And that is due to a law passed in 1994 called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, which was written in large part directly by industry lobbyists, which forbade the FDA from ever requiring those things before supplements were sold. And what's particularly interesting about that law is that it was passed in large part with help of the American consumers, whom the supplement industry had convinced the American public that they might lose access to vitamins like vitamin C if the FDA were allowed to have its way. And the FDA actually did not want to try to take anyone's vitamins away. They were trying at that point to regulate health claims on supplement products. But it ended up being this perfect entree for the nascent supplement industry to get a much larger foothold and get this law passed that really took a lot of powers away from the FDA in ways that affect us today.
Mm-hmm. So the FDA effectively forbidden to compel supplemental makers to test products. And basically, they are required, however, to say that if you say on the label that something is in your supplements, it should be in there. How do we know if a vitamin or supplement is any good?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, unfortunately. There actually are huge problems in the supplement industry about products not containing what they say they should. The last figure I heard is that the FDA was finding a rate of 70%, 70, of violations in the facilities that it inspected.
Wowie. So what kind of offenses would that be?
So in that case, it would be things like not having what it said on the label, not having the ingredients and the quantities said on the label, having other contaminants like heavy metals that weren't revealed or potential allergens, not dissolving properly, which obviously, again, getting back to our urine conversation, you want to have the supplement dissolve right, otherwise you're not going to get what's in it, and then just other labeling problems.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tell people to do if they really want to take dietary supplements, then I think that they should do their own homework. And that requires looking to a third-party organization who actually does test these things to check to see if what they have is what they say they have on the label. And, you know, one of those is consumerlab.com, which does a great job of pulling these things off the shelves and testing. Or you can look for a seal from USP Verified is the name of the seal, or NSF. And there's another company called labdoor.com that just came out.
When you talk about food in America, there's often this revelation of suspicion and divisions. I mean, I know plenty of people who turn their nose up at processed foods yet swear by synthetic vitamins and supplements with what I would compare to what you call in the book a kind of quasi-religious fervor. So, in other words, people who are rejecting industrial food and big pharma, but in some ways supporting big vitamins. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is an interesting dichotomy there. You do have a lot of people who say, oh, I would never eat processed foods, but I take 30 supplements every morning. And that's interesting to me because in terms of the vitamin supplements, again, those 13 vitamins, those are going to be synthetic if they're in the pill and they're synthetic in food. And honestly, it doesn't matter that much for most vitamins if it's synthetic or naturally occurring. What's more important is the context. In other words, if you have a food that naturally contains a vitamin, like an orange and vitamin C, it's got a lot of other beneficial things in it that would not be replaced in a multivitamin. But it is kind of funny to me that we do have this kind of crunchy, all-natural feeling when it comes to dietary supplements and vitamins. And that is, I think, an erroneous perception to have because it actually is, it's a huge business. I mean, the latest estimates are $36 billion a year for dietary supplements. It's not like someone just growing herbs in their backyard.
Mm. Well, Catherine Price, a fascinating book. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Catherine Price, a journalist whose writing has appeared in the Best American Science Writing and the Washington Post, among other places. You can find more on her book, Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. It's now out in paperback. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. We're so grateful for some of your time and attention today and want you to know there's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org or with the Word of Mouth podcast, which you can listen to anytime. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. That'll help others to find it when shared by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.